Yes.
And so, I mean, Christine, obviously, I mean, Heather and I were just sitting and talking about this. I mean, what do you do? You know, it's like what you see. You get this information now, and as a district, what do we do? You know, where are we empowered to make some of these changes? And, you know, obviously, this is a little alarming. I mean, more so than, I mean, you guys have already, you know, seen this. But for the first time, you see this in black and white, and it's like, okay, now what do we do?
Now I wish I had one more bullet on this slide, because you would be astounded at the terrific performance of the largest majority of our teachers.
Right.
We have so many excellent teachers and so many more very strong, very solid teachers.
And yes. To me, I think that that's amazing, because we can see that in our scores. Mm-hmm. But you also do worry about these kids that are in these classrooms with these particular ineffective, you know.
Well, we have limited resources, but if we knew right where to put it, maybe we could put a co-teacher in some cases, or maybe we could let that teacher not teach math if they clearly are, you know, not.
And I guess my being alarmed, maybe that's exactly what I'm asking you is, you know, what are some of the things that we could do, you know, to change this?
Yeah, let me talk about that rather than cornering Christine.
I'm not trying to corner her at all. I'm not.
I have lots of ideas, so let's let Mikkel go there.
And not to minimize at any level, but 20 to 25 teachers in 17 Title I schools, so you're talking one or two per school, that's not a surprise. It's an unfortunate reality that we're trying to address in terms of support and change. And so the data has evolved to the point of where it now informs and isn't criticized just in and of itself. So ideally, now that we have a more elaborate way to provide that feedback, our remediation system should be able to then verify that, yep, you've got the right 20 to 25 teachers. Do we have the capacity to provide remediation to then help them become successful or to get them coached out of the system? That's the intent of the remedial model. But we've only had the capacity to do 2 to 5 teachers a year through that more in-depth focused effort on their ability to be successful with kids. So we have a capacity gap now that we have better information that we're going to have to address. How are we going to invest more remedial teams with the right individuals to either help them become successful or recognize that they need a different career? That's where our next step.
And we have to remember that we have one-year contracts for all new teachers for first 3 years of their career. So,
but they're improving our median. It's not the new teachers, Rosemary.
So it's not our last 5 years.
No, that you just heard that. It's
well,
not.
Well, I mean, I heard the, but I mean, a career teacher could be somebody who's been in the system 5 years, in my opinion, because there's only 3 years window. Well, you know, and I always have had a concern, I've had a concern as a teacher when I do CRTs with my ELL kids, because clearly they know, or a lot of them knew a lot more math than they could generate on those tests because of the language issue. Now, is that coming through at all in any of this testing, or is anyone looking at the bias of some of the testing with the ELL kids?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, because ELL students mostly are a benefit to teachers on the growth model, because you're an English language learner, you're coming along fairly quickly. So we're only comparing an ELL student to other students who scored similarly low the prior
ELL
year.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it actually the ELL doesn't bias.
Okay. Good.
Can I ask a question about this? A few years ago, we received a report about the relative length of service of teachers in Title I and non-Title I schools. And it seemed that they were remarkably similar at that point in time. And I just wonder if this look at the data that you've been doing confirms or denies that perception.
I think one of the things that happens is, depending on how we choose to lump teachers into categories, mm-hmm. you know, if we said how many first-year teachers in schools, Title I versus non-Title I, it wouldn't be evenly distributed. But if you said how about in their first 5 years, it might be. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon for teachers to go into a West Side school and in 3 to 5 years they actually successfully transfer to an east side school.
Right.
And so you might lose some of that detail.
And then there are some teachers who choose to go west, but probably a smaller
Very number. Small numbers.
And then the other question that came to my mind was this last bullet point, the lowest growth teachers at the bottom effectiveness level, are to be found in Title I schools. But you also said that it's somewhat challenging to measure that same growth in the same way in the higher socioeconomic status populations. So
that's true.
Is it possible that there are equally ineffective teachers whose ineffectiveness is masked just by the general support
population
that a child has from the home? Or
it looks different in the east side schools. If you have students who are generally pretty high performing and they stayed generally high performing in the past, that always looked great. So if you have complaints about this from constituents, it will likely be teachers in east side schools, because some teachers who, yes, all their students are still proficient, but their students actually kind of lost ground compared to other high-performing students. So there are a few teachers in east side schools who had a little bit of a, could have a wake-up call, or they could choose to ignore the report. But it's true that those lowest growth teachers, if you move them to an east side school, they might be kind of okay. They're not good at doing strong remediation of students, but they might be okay. They might have a lot of other great qualities, making learning fun and doing a lot of music and art and being okay. And the same, if we move teachers from the east side to the west, we may find some more teachers who are not strong with helping really low-performing students catch up fast.
Well, and I do think teachers are very concerned with this whole.
Yes.
And so there are teachers who, I don't know if it's more, but I would assume there are more teachers moving who, you know, say, I want to transfer maybe. And I don't know if that's true or not.
To move them to get into an
east side school.
It's interesting in the west side, the teachers who have been having good results, man, they love this report, and they just said, thank you so much.
Right.
This makes me feel so sure that all this work I'm doing is really
right.
What I need to be doing.
So they're hanging in. Right.
But the wrong test across the country that doesn't look at student growth in a thoughtful way, that phenomenon occurs a lot where you transfer to the school where you can't tell your effort, it's the kids.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
Amanda?
I just wanted to just clarify something on the last one. You mentioned that it's, you know, maybe one or two teachers per school. There's not a cluster of more than one or two students at a particular school and none. So
teachers,
yes. So of the ineffective or the lowest growth teachers, there's not more than one or two at a school. I'm just well, concerned that there's a cluster of teachers is what I'm just wondering.
Just trying to think.
There's not
one school.
There's not a huge dark cloud. And there's not a huge bright sun. But one of the things that was way fascinating, again, with the recognitions of teachers, is that collaborative effort is so important to understand and recognize and celebrate. That grade level achievement clustered across grade levels, when you measured kindergarten through sixth grade, happened in 7 different schools. So you could imagine